Our panel today has got an interesting blend of experience from the planning side through construction and management and operations. We've got more than a half century of experience up here and a range in background from the folks on the electrical engineering side down to what I would consider sort of the frontline troops actually going out and siting routes and so forth. The order in which we plan to speak is with Randy Oy first from Xcel, then Claire Moeller from MISO, Ed Weber from WAPA, and then Craig Porker from Great River Energy. And again, we'll follow the format of roughly 8 to 10 minute presentations and then have questions and answers at the end. So with that, Randy, if you want to go first.
Hi, I'm Randy Oy with Xcel Energy. I work in the Minneapolis office. Xcel has offices in Colorado and Texas as well. My experience is mostly, well, it's all Minnesota, Minnesota wind, and primarily Buffalo Ridge. And in case you don't know where Buffalo Ridge is, it's that red area in the southwest part of Minnesota. Most of the wind generation that we have is concentrated there. Right now, I think at the end of the month, we'll have close to 1,000 megawatts online. 55 megawatts of that is actually in South Dakota, as was mentioned earlier. The goals of my presentation, and I didn't bring these with, I'm going to provide some details on the renewable energy standard. That was discussed a little bit earlier, so I won't go too detailed into that. Discuss what it means to Xcel Energy. Discuss a couple ideas that we threw around for wind in South Dakota, near-term, mid-term, possibly without a significant amount of transmission required, and then some of the transmission barrier, non-transmission barriers that have been brought up, you know, the FERC interconnection queue being the key one. The Minnesota Renewable Plan was passed in 2007. Xcel Energy is going to need to build approximately 2,900 megawatts of wind by 2025. These numbers are different than Terry Grove's. I pulled it out of a biennial plan with a different assumption. That's why his numbers were actually quite a bit lower. When we get done, Xcel Energy, you know, with using these numbers here, Xcel Energy is going to have built 43% of the wind required to meet the renewable standard. And at that point, we will likely represent 50% of total renewable generation in the state of Minnesota. And by that, I mean we're going to either be buying it or owning it. Minnesota Xcel Energy is very lucky because of the location. We're in the center of a very good renewable area. We can get wind from South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota and Iowa. It's a, you know, very good thing for us, but then there's some, it creates some issues as well. And the big issue that we're kind of grappling with is after a lot of this wind is generated or developed, the load isn't necessarily going to be high enough to support it all. For example, a peak in NSP right now might be 9,000 megawatts. There's often days when we're sitting at 4,000 or 5,000. If we build 3,000 megawatts of wind, you know, we just it just doesn't work because a lot of that generation is base load. You can't turn it down, so you got to do something with it. So the options, you know, the first one is reducing output of the base load units. You know, it doesn't really work very well. Those plants are not designed to move up and down. They're designed to run at base load. Another option is store the energy. There's not a lot of options there. Xcel Energy has a pilot program they're doing with batteries. We actually are putting in a 1-megawatt battery that has 6 megawatt hours of capacity, and we're testing that to see if that can help a little bit with the, you know, balancing out or smoothing out the wind generation. The idea to develop intermittent loads is kind of a, you know, it's called vehicle to grid. XL isn't really, you know, there's no pilot programs yet, but the company is buying a few plug-in hybrids. And the idea is you plug them in, and when you need the, you charge them at night, and if you need the energy at the day, during the day, you can discharge them. You know, it's not, that's not where XL is at. We're just kind of testing the vehicles right now, but that's an idea that has been floated around. They could be charged, you know, using wind energy, I guess is the thought. Something we use now in southwest Minnesota is curtailing wind. And the reason we curtail it is there's not enough transmission. It's very expensive. We don't like to do that. So going forward, you know, with this renewable plan, we really don't want to do that. So really the only answer for us is to sell energy from the wind generation. We can't always use this wind that we, you know, are going to buy, so we're going to want to sell it. So the question is where can we sell it? And the only answer is to the east. Dale Osborne and a number of people have talked about this. But, you know, the loads are Chicago and further east. It's to the beyond us. So something that always we talk about wind generation, we got a key on load. Who wants it? You know, that's a key point. I hear a lot here talking about, you know, the generation, you want to do generation. But the key is you got to find people and find source or find places to put the load. To get out of Minnesota right now, there's really one major line heading east, and that's from, I guess, Eau Claire ARP, and that's that red line up there. The red line that's higher up is Arrowhead Weston. I think that's complete now. I'm not sure about that, but that comes from northern Minnesota and heads into Wisconsin. There's also a line south out of the Twin Cities, but it's very limited what you can go east. Those lines, there's no capacity on those lines. So to meet the renewable standard, we're also going to have to build east. It's not just building from the west and from the wind areas to Minnesota. It's building east out of Minnesota, too. I guess that was my conclusion. We just got to build east and west, I guess, from the west into the east. So the other thing I wanted to bring up was some opportunities for South Dakota wind. A lot of this was already discussed. One thing that has been discussed by XL and others is exploiting underutilized transmission capacity and then overcoming some of the transmission barriers. The first thing that's been discussed by a lot of people is creating what we're calling campuses for wind energy combined with such things as gas and possibly hydro. The idea is there is the combustion turbines, the ones we own, we have transmission rights. So we can add some level of wind to the gas turbines and use that transmission when the combustion turbines aren't operating, which is a pretty good deal because the combustion turbines may operate, you know, between 5 and 10% or somewhere in there. So they're not utilized that often. They're also utilized during peak, and wind is a lot of times more of an off-peak, on-off-peak. The other option was hydro, and I believe Bob talked a lot about that. South Dakota has a significant amount of hydro. They have transmission for it. Ed Weber might be able to talk about that a little more, but the possibility exists for significant wind and hydro. The other barrier that I want to talk about was brought up in the last session, and it's the FERC generation interconnection process. I used to always call it the MISO interconnection process, but it's really the FERC. It's not MISO. MISO just, MISO is just following what FERC requires. And this is, I think from August, there's been 20,000 more megawatts added. You know, if you look at it close, and I apologize, these slides aren't included in your handouts. I changed a bunch of these on the way here. The transmission lines are the little lines in the bottom, and the EHV 1800 is CapEx, and that's the last one planned. And from that, you can see that most of the projects fall in after that. And it's a major hurdle for, you know, for us as Xcel, if we want to buy projects, and we're out for RFPs and a lot of projects, and they might be, you know, in the group five or, you know, halfway up, and, you know, there's a lot of unknowns with it. Nobody knows how much transmission they're going to need, which means they don't know what it's going to cost, which means they can't really bid it accurately. So there's a lot of risk that this introduces into the wind projects, and it makes it difficult for us to go forward. Claire is going to talk about this a lot. I guess our position is we'd like to see this changed. Right now it's kind of a first in, and it's, you know, whoever's in first has the first rights, and then the generators can also suspend it. We'd like to see something more where the people that get, you know, advanced through the process are the ones that are ready to go. They have viable projects. They have turbines. They have PPAs, you know, or they're ready to enter the market. But we think the process needs to kind of get rid of first in, first rights, and then the suspension needs to be kind of made less, or, you know, maybe throw it out. I'm not sure. But Claire will cover that, a lot of that. Anyway, I just want to say that the renewable standard offers a lot of opportunities for Minnesota wind and South Dakota wind. Xcel Energy will, you know, we don't know exactly where we're going to get it all, but we're going to do what's best for our ratepayers, and South Dakota has a good resource. It's going to be, you know, competitive if some of the little issues with the MISO, the FERC interconnection queue and the pancake tariffs and things are resolved, it should look real good for Minnesota, but that's going to take cooperation from all kinds of organizations. Thank you.
The great thing about being from the Midwest ISO is if it's broke, it's our fault. The queue problem is a significant issue facing us. It's virtually intractable, and it's getting worse. If I can figure out which way is forward. As we've talked a lot about, the existing queue requirement is a first-in, first-out kind of requirement. The FERC Order 2003 was a public rulemaking that involved essentially the entire country of all FERC jurisdictional utilities. As was mentioned, and I believe by a question, it was designed around the then-dominant generation project, which were predominantly simple cycle combustion turbines in load centers. Not a lot of transmission issues. They work pretty good. The real problem is the dependency on the first in, first out. When you have a lot of projects that are competing for the load and they're a long ways away from that load, the first in, first out, if we took it literally and took the 70-some thousand megawatts that are in our queue and did them end-to-end, it would take us till 2362 in August to clear that queue on a first-in, first-out. Now, we've done a bunch of tricks to try to accelerate that, and if we use those tricks, we can get all the way to 2050, which, you know, the feedback I get from some of y'all, and oddly enough from a lot of governors, is 2050 is still too slow, so what are you going to do next is kind of the question we always get. It's that 200 to 600 mile problem that is the real problem with that generation queue design. When you have competing projects that are looking at the same region and you have to look at the first project before you can process the second project, if the first project disappears, then your assumptions that you use to study the second project are no longer valid, and you have to go back. Okay, and with 300-some projects in the queue, by the time you get to number 300, you've got a lot of turbulence in terms of what projects actually are going on, and you get a lot of restudy as a result of that. There's a lot of churn involved. That withdrawn request is a real problem in terms of getting through the queue. This is an example of how the queues change. Particularly the wind queue additions are dramatically higher than they were in the early part of the Midwest ISO. And year to date, we've had 188 new requests, and we still got a couple of months left. When I talked to Hunter, I don't remember when that was. It was before August. The number was 30,000 megawatts of wind in the queue. As of November, it was 55, and I called our guys earlier today, and now it's 58,000 megawatts. I'm going to build an ark because I've got a flood of biblical proportions on my hands. Of that, 26,000 of it is in Minnesota in terms of queue requests. South Dakota follows at second with 11,000, and you can read the rest of it. You put that together, and we've got the 58,000 megawatts of wind, and we've got renewable portfolio standards of almost 13,000. So I've got 60,000 megawatts of supply chasing 13,000 megawatts of demand. And that's the real problem in the queue. Another problem, we talked a little bit about suspension. A suspended project is one that gets through the process all the way to interconnection agreement, and then for various reasons, whether it's financing or a PPA is unfinished or whatever it is, they have the option to suspend for up to 3 years. During that suspension, the projects that are later than them in the queue have to wait to see what is going to happen to that project. Of the total amount of projects, about a quarter of them suspend, but it's a bigger number when it looks at a wind project. The wind projects, almost 2,000 out of 4,000 megawatts have suspended. So there's 2,000 megawatts of wind projects that have interconnection agreements that could go forward that have suspended for one reason or another. And then the projects behind them have to wait for up to 3 years to see what happens, to see whether or not they can go forward and use that same capacity. So that bottleneck, as Randy pointed out, is a significant problem that we're going to have to find a way to fix. The green dots are the queued requests. Red lines are 345 kilovolts, and the blue ones are 230 kV. You'll note that the green dots are where there aren't any wires. That's the reality. The region where the wind is the richest, there isn't a lot of infrastructure because there isn't a lot of load. If you think about Buffalo Ridge area, Randy, what is it, 50 megawatts of load, more or less? And I've got 22,000 megawatts of queued requests. So it's two orders of magnitude different in terms of the infrastructure that was there before the wind requests started arriving. This is another chart that is very similar to the one that Randy put up without quite so much detail. You know, the reality is there are some very big projects that took a very long time to achieve regulatory approval for. That gets us about 2,000 megawatts of export capability from Buffalo Ridge, and it gets done in about 2014. I've got 20,000 megawatts more requests that want to use that capacity than the capacity that we're currently planning to construct off of Buffalo Ridge. A 345 kilovolt line will carry nominally between 500 and 1,000 megawatts. You're not going to build 24 lines out of Buffalo Ridge at 3045 kV. The politics of that will sink it. So that's why the bigger voltages are part of what we're currently talking about. As we try to figure out what's going to happen in 2027 or some date like that, we have to make up some estimates of what the appropriate amount of generation might be. In our planning process, because there's so little known about what generation will be out there in 2015 or 2020. We've developed about four scenarios, different possibilities. One scenario is what we call the reference case, which is essentially a no policy change case. What kind of generation would be built if there's no policy change? That's the bar on the my right, your left. So, you know, business as normal. That takes care of the 13,000 megawatts that are current capacity mandates. The second bar is our estimate of how much wind would be required if there were a 20% mandate in the Midwest ISO. So that only serves the Midwest ISO's mandate. And you'll see that's about a 40,000 megawatt of installed capacity requirement across the entire market footprint. And then you see the 55 there, or 58 actually, which is about 40% more than that, is currently in the queued request. So in terms of this supply-demand balance, we still have a supply-demand balance of about 20,000 megawatts, which is the size of a really big utility. 20,000 megawatts is not trivial. NSP, the big utility in the neighborhood, is about 9,000. So it's not a trivial number by any stretch. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that, but somebody mentioned earlier that you're not going to miss a 765 kV line when you cross it. I had the opportunity in my career to try to license and construct transmission lines. I spent 3 years once on 7 miles of 69 kilovolt stuff in Sawyer County near Hayward, Wisconsin. We're talking about thousands of miles of 765 kV. The political will to construct that is where the real question is. It's not, you know, we've talked a lot about the physics. We've talked some about the process, which is Q. The real problem is politics. You can't make a 765 kV line look good in anybody's backyard, right? And I promise you that the folks at the public hearing, the interested public, isn't going to line up with the public interest, right? And that's the reality of the political process to get this size infrastructure built. I'm going to skip through a bunch of them. I'm going to go on this one a little bit. This is the group study idea. What we've learned on group studies is that when people see how big the number is for transmission, they tend to get out of the queue. This particular one was in the Thumb area of Michigan. We started the study with 600 megawatts. By the time it was done, we had 194 megawatts. The RFP that the local utility had was 200 megawatts. So what happened was the queue disappeared until you got to the demand. And so that's the reality of the issue we're facing. So what are you going to do about it? One of the things that one of our critics says loud and often is that the generation interconnection queue is a poor place to do your transmission planning, which is an accurate statement. The problem is when the generation is what is the causal effect of the transmission, we're having a hard time getting out of that box. So one of our proposals is going to be to look towards more of an open season kind of approach. It's not as simple as a CREZ like they're doing in the other states, because I haven't got a single state with a consistent energy policy. I've got, you know, no mandate in South Dakota. I have a 35% mandate in Minnesota. I got an 8% goal in Iowa. I've got, 10% in Wisconsin. So I got all this mishmash that makes it hard to just, you know, pick an answer and build towards it. But we're going to have to learn how to pick an answer and build towards it. The other thing is in the generation interconnection queue, if any of you have been participating in our public process, we're going to recommend that we move from a first-in, first-out to a first-finished, first-out. The only thing wrong with that is it's a hard mnemonic, f-f-f-f-f-f. But the reality is if you don't find a way to let projects that are mature move forward through the queue, we're going to stay in this constant queue constipation. There's going to be different winners and losers about that. And so those of you that report to governors, I'd ask you to help them understand that they're still going to get calls. It's just going to be different people, right? So that's the reality of that. So at the end of the day, we need to move to a build that they will come. We need to find cost-sharing mechanisms. You know, the real problem with transmission isn't finding people who want to build it. I can find all kinds of them. Well, the hard part is finding somebody who wants to pay for it. Oddly enough, there's none of them, right? And so that's, again, a political question, not a technical one. And then that regional energy policy consensus would be really valuable in terms of finding a philosophy that we can stand on and follow. It's a little bit like the policy slide from the earlier presentation. If we can stay on a plan for a while, we can get it done. If we change the plan every week, we're going to be in trouble. And I suspect I'll get a few questions when we're done.
Thanks, Claire. And while Ed's coming up, I forget to introduce these guys because I've talked to them so much on the phone that I forget you all don't know them already, too. Just wanted to mention that don't get nervous looking at your watches too much. The folks know we may be starting the reception a little bit late, but that means stuff will still be there. So do be thinking of questions that you have at the end.
Thanks, Katie. It's nice to be here. I've spoken at a few of these before, and this is by far the largest group that I've addressed, and it's a real pleasure to be here. Just to put things in perspective of what Claire was saying about 765s is you would barely be able to fit the tower base of a 765 in this room, and it's about four times as tall as this ceiling. So just imagine standing under one of those 765 towers. They're truly awesome structures, and you've got one of those about every, maybe three-quarters of a mile, 1,100 feet. Okay, so that's probably, five per mile. You can't miss them if you've ever seen one. So, anyway, my presentation, I'm going to have a little bit of a different approach. I'm not going to talk so much about the queue, although we're suffering from the same queue constipation. I got to remember that term. That's great. we've got probably about 9,000 megawatts in our queue with about 70 requests right now. We've got a few big ones. We are trying to process them as quickly as we can. I'm just going to start briefly for those of you who don't know about Western. I guess, first off, is how many of you are actually residents of South Dakota who are members of a municipal or cooperative system who would receive Western power? Can you raise your hands? Oh, this is great. So I do have some allies in the room then. If you look in your folder, it seems like the action plan, if Western had just get their act together, this whole solution would be right in front of us. Well, it's not quite that simple. That's what Claire says, too. Geez, if MISO would just get their act together, we'd have all this figured out. So it really is a very complex issue, and so I hope you appreciate what we're doing. Just a quick overview of Western. We are one of the major transmission players in the West, and we do generate a lot of megawatts. I'll jump to the next slide. I'm going to try to move through this because there's nothing worse than being at the end of the day and standing between a crowd of 200 and the reception with food and drink and all that. So I'm going to go fairly quickly. The upper right-hand corner of the map there, the green, is the upper Great Plains region. That's easy for me to say. And that's where primarily I'm going to be addressing. That's our backyard, and that's what I'm transmission planning manager for that area. This shows our transmission system. Western has about 15,000 miles of transmission. It is high voltage. We primarily 345 and 230. The Upper Great Plains region has about 7,500 miles of line. So Upper Great Plains has about half of all of Western's transmission. We have other regions, Rocky Mountain in Wyoming, and clear down into Arizona and sections in California too. So Western has always had an open access transmission policy, clear back into the 70s. We have, as part of the cooperative system that we've had with our members, we've we've opened our transmission system to members and whoever is wanted to move power across it. And we've done that for many, many years. In the 1990s, we did file a tariff with FERC, and it was accepted. We are considered non-jurisdictional, but the FERC was accepted, has accepted our tariff. And we have then also in the tariff process, we have added the large generator interconnection, as the one gentleman said, the large generator interconnection conditions, which kind of govern the way we handle large generators interconnections. And the majority of our requests right now in our queue are for wind, are considered large generators. So that's a fairly lengthy process. We did just recently, this last spring, amend our tariff to include smaller generators, and that is less than 20 megawatts. So smaller projects do have more of a streamlined process to use. I might add that as a federal agency, we do have an obligation under the interconnection to a federal process to go through a fairly lengthy environmental process. And that oftentimes is viewed as a real bottleneck for some projects in our region because, you know, we got to do the environmental thing. Well, it's for good reason. One of the things that, that Western can help with in solving this transmission issue is we do have some pretty broad construction authorities under the federal legislation. We can build transmission. We can do it for both project specific and to you know, avoid. Excuse me, I jumped a slide here. Nope, that's okay. We build transmission in two different ways, through the tariff, or we can do it for reliability-based reasons, expanding load growth. Now, we don't have load growth responsibility, but as a transmission provider, we're obligated to meet the needs of our member systems. And so our partners, the municipal systems and the cooperatives, as their loads are growing, we are obligated to add transmission facilities. As a result, we have not just been sitting on our hands either. Over the last 10 years, Western has spent significant amount of money, probably close to $50 million, on transmission improvements to allow load growth and increased or improved reliability in our area. So it isn't like we're just at a standstill and paralyzed because of the wind industry asking for interconnections. We're moving ahead with a lot of those. Interestingly, in the Energy Policy Act of 2005 gave Westerns even some expanded authorities, and I won't go through all of them, but it's interesting to look at that, and you've probably read in the paper about the DOE National Interest Electric Corridors, and they're being sued every which way from Sunday because of the authority that was given to them under this mandate, particularly the states of Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, are contesting the DOE's ability to just address corridors. We're not even talking actually building transmission yet. We're just identifying potential corridors for some of these large transmission lines. And that goes to kind of some of the issues that we've talked about already, some of the speakers, is it's not going to be trivial politically to build transmission, to move wind to the load centers in this country. One of the things that we do have that kind of we feel like might be a bit of a hindrance is the law did cap third-party funding to Western at $100 million. But even $100 million will barely build 100 miles of transmission line in this day and age. So 100 miles isn't even going to get us hardly from Sioux Falls to Minneapolis. So, I mean, that, the reality of that is Western will be relying on our partners and others for funding. Okay, what are the challenges? If you remember the three questions that were asked, what are we doing near term, long term? Well, we see the timing of construction is really a challenge for us. Even if we were to process everything in the queue, the lead time for ordering equipment, design of facilities, the environmental process that we must go through, even the very simplest cookie-cutter transmission interconnection is probably going to take us 2 years to get it in and up and running. Well, obviously that's not acceptable for some of the wind projects who would like to get done by the end of 2008. Okay, count on your fingers and toes. That's only 13 months away. If we were to start today, we couldn't do it. So it's a difficult challenge. Also, the question of congestion. Even if you provide an interconnection in the time frame needed, you're not necessarily going to be able to deliver that energy to the point that you want because of congestion. And that speaks to a number of issues. And Claire asked me if I was going to talk about seams issues, and I'd rather avoid that if I can. But I'm sure we'll be talking a bit more about that. But trying to get our power from the Western system into the Midwest ISO is proving very, very difficult because of the seam between the two. And there's a number of reasons for that, and it would take more than 8 minutes for me to get through that, so I'll just move right along. The other, and probably, you know, I mean, Claire hit it right on the head, is cost allocation. How do we develop a regional tariff and a regional policy that will have the people who benefit from the development and from the wind energy pay for it? And I'm not saying that we here in South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota should not pay our fair share. But by the same token, if we're going to be exporting large amounts of green energy to the rest of the country, they should have to pay for a portion of the transmission. We shouldn't have all of the bad side and they get all the good side. That's just not equitable. So let's talk about the timing issues real quick. I did mention it. We, over the last 5 years, have probably picked all of the low-hanging fruit off of our transmission system. We still do have, some opportunities. But the major infrastructure is really getting the margin is getting squeezed out of it, and it isn't just Western system, it's all of the systems throughout the country right now. We are getting a bit gray around the temples, and as I said, we've spent a major amount of money, going into refurbishing some of our older facilities. Let's talk about congestion for a minute. One of the interesting things about the upper Midwest, and I think Claire touched on it a bit, is this 200 to 600 mile distance thing. We have a lot of wires in the air in South Dakota and North Dakota both, and we have a great robust system for delivering our hydro resource to our customers. But that causes some interesting problems. These wires give us plenty of thermal capacity, and that is we have a pipe big enough to carry all of our electrons. So merely adding, pushing more through it really doesn't help us that much. What we do have and what we consider the issue for us is our stability limit. And stability is the interaction of a generator with the rest of the system. And wind is a peculiar animal in that they react differently than the traditional generators. And so they take a special way to study them, and they cause some special opportunities, not necessarily problems. We do find that wind can be very helpful in certain instances. So again, if you look at the bottom line there, we feel that the pipe or the transmission system in South Dakota does have enough carrying capability, but the overall system just doesn't have the capability to integrate a lot of wind. And that's a regional issue. I mean, if we trip a unit in North Dakota, they see it in Winnipeg, they see it in the Twin Cities, they see it clear down in Chicago. That's because we are so fragile and so stability limited. And that's an issue that is a technical issue that we're going to have to solve. And then, this just kind of just goes to what I just said, is increasing the size of the pipe really doesn't help much. We need to put more pipes or more wires in the air. And I'm going to jump here just to the cost allocation, and I'm not going to say a lot about that, but I think that final bullet says it all, and that's the use of the systems. You know, it becomes, as we have more and more players in the system, more and more customers, more generators, it's really difficult to determine who the beneficiaries are of a transmission infrastructure addition. Who pays? I mean, is it the folks who have the turbines in their yard? Should they pay more than the neighbor next door who doesn't have a turbine and doesn't get a payment, but has to look at the turbine and look at the line going through his field? I mean, that's a difficult issue, and that's a policy issue that I think a lot of us have said we need to address that on a regional basis. So what are the transmission opportunities, I guess? Oh, did I skip one? Transmission opportunities. That was a slide behind. I'm sorry. Congestion indicates, the need for additional facilities, and we need to come up with a process to figure out how the entities that benefit from that, and I guess I just said that, is I don't know, I don't have an easy answer, and I guess that's why I'm standing up here with the rest of us saying, it's a problem, but what's a solution? And hopefully we can come up with some ideas here in the next day and a half to figure out how to do that. What Western can bring to the table is we are experienced transmission builders and operators. We've done this for over 50 years. And for those of you who have been our customers, we hope that we have served you well. We do know that our role is fairly limited on a regional basis, and that is based on the legislation that governs us. We're pretty careful as a government agency to not step outside those bounds. So just, I guess, in summary, all of the low-hanging fruit has been taken off. We're working diligently to figure out how to expand the system to the benefit of the region and yet not put an overwhelming burden on our existing transmission customers. We really do feel like we can be a major player in the transmission enhancement and expansion in South Dakota, and we look forward to working with our customers and our interconnected utilities to make that happen. So thank you.
Thanks, Ed. Craig, you want to come up? Craig's with Great River Energy and also the routing lead on the Brookings line. Are you going to do it?
Thank you, Katie. Can I use this one? Is that
sure.
All right?
Yeah.
I've been drinking coffee all afternoon, and I can't stand still very well. Last speaker of the day, how lucky am I? Katie's holding a sign right here that says 45 minutes. I can assure you it's going to be much less than that. And for those of you that have consultants here, you're paying them by the hour, I will talk really fast. Again, I'm Craig Porker with Great River Energy, and I'm the routing lead for the Brookings, for the CapEx Brookings to Southeast Twin Cities transmission line. And this is a map of our project area. It's these corridors right here are notice corridors, and it's about 600 miles worth of projects. And the one Brookings to Southeast Twin Cities is about 200 miles of transmission line with an associated transmission line between Marshall and Granite Falls. And we wanted to talk about, with this session today, about transmission challenges and opportunities, but I'm going to talk not about wires and poles and things like that or queue situations. I'm going to talk about people instead. One of our challenges when we're siting transmission lines is informing and educating the public. Effective public outreach and communication, meaningful public involvement, involving the public so that they feel that they are involved and not just going through an exercise, establishing relationships, and also easement acquisition, permit, and license acquisition as well. And one of our biggest challenges, of course, is time. So what opportunities do we have to address these issues? Number one is education and educating, I think, the public about increased electricity use. There hasn't been a lot of transmission construction in the last 25 years, and a lot has changed since that time. Economic vitality depends on a reliable electric supply. And without that, our businesses are going to slow down and their expansion is going to slow down. Electric consumption in Minnesota has doubled since 1980 and with very few transmission upgrades since that time. A lot of us have seen a lot of development that's gone on in our neighborhoods and the cities where we live. And the average home now is 40% larger than it was 30 years ago. The percentage of homes with central air conditioning has doubled in the last 25 years, and I don't think there's hardly a home built now that doesn't have central air conditioning. Some of them have two central air conditioning units, and probably some have more than that. More than 75% of the homes in 2006 had a computer versus 40% in 1997, and 0% in 1977. I think the closest thing we had to electronics in 77 was the video game Pong, of which I was household champion. In 1975, half of the households had just one TV, but today half of all homes have more than three TVs. A lot of us have teenagers that feel that they have to have their own computer in their room, their own TV in their room. And so consumption has gone up considerably in the last 30 years. So we also have opportunities for public outreach and communication. The CapEx projects have started over a year ago, almost a year and a half ago, notifying the public and doing some public outreach. We've had over 100 meetings with local government units, the news media, civic groups, farm groups, and it goes on and on. In June, we sent out 73,000 letters to landowners in those in our notice areas, those shaded areas there for all 600 miles of proposed transmission line, and we only received about 300 calls and emails in response. They still trickle in, maybe a couple emails every day, maybe a couple phone calls. We also sent out letters to 400 local government officials. The first round of open houses, we sent out another 73,000 notices to the people in these corridors by direct mail, announcing our open houses that were coming up in September and October. We notified people by direct mail, newspaper ads, and we also notified government officials to try to get people involved as well. Some of the public information materials that we used were fact sheets, maps. We had construction videos and comment forms. I really urge people to fill out comment forms, and if they didn't want to fill them out at our open house, take them along with you, take them home, and mail them back. Our open houses that we had in September and October, we had 24 of them, and we had 1,800 attendees. It was a very busy time, and it felt like we had a lot of people there, but when you realize we sent out 73,000 letters to landowners and residents, that's still not a good turnout. So we're still working on our public outreach effort. And one thing we did find was a huge support for wind energy. So yes, they love wind turbines, but they don't like transmission lines quite so much yet. So what about future outreach? Outreach doesn't change, or it doesn't stop, it just changes as your project goes on. We're going to have additional rounds of open houses probably associated with the routing process, and probably through January through June of next year. We're going to have several open houses, and we're going to have work groups as well. We attend district meetings of different township associations or county associations, and we attend state conferences. We're always being invited to have a booth at a certain event, and sometimes we even invite ourselves to some of the conferences. Newsletter, we've told everybody on our projects that we're going to keep them informed of our project through newsletters and email alerts. And we're going to continue giving progress reports to our stakeholders that we've been visiting with for the last year and a half. And I also envision when it comes time for construction that we're still going to have public involvement, and it's going to be, of course, much different, but I can see us having weekly construction progress meetings along our project, just to keep landowners informed and affected property owners. Meaningful public involvement is another opportunity. The CapEx 2020 utilities are very sensitive to landowner and public concerns. After all, a lot of us are landowners ourselves. And we're placing a high priority on public participation. We urge people to attend our public meetings and hearings, fill out comment cards. They can provide comments on the certificate of need, which was recently filed, and route permits in the future to the Public Utilities Commissions. We do urge people to get involved in those, and also to submit comments, and they can find our schedules on capex2020.com, which is our project website. And they can add their name to the project mailing list through that website, or they can call a toll-free number, and somebody in our office usually answers that number when they call. They do get a live voice, and they can get placed on mailing lists that way as well. Next year, we're going to start forming working groups. We're actually going to get the public involved, sitting around tables and just discussing routing and the routing process, and help the public get involved in that process as well. We hope to solicit farm groups, neighborhood groups, environmental groups, county planners to get involved in helping us to find a route for this project. Establishing relationships, I think, is critical. Take all the time that you have, and that should be a lot of time, to answer questions that people have and get their input. What we like to tell people is that we'll come anywhere, anytime, and stay as long as we have to. We tell people we'll stay till sunup, or if we have to. And last night we had a meeting in the far east central part of Minnesota, and we were there almost until daylight. But if it wasn't winter, if it was summer, it would have been close. So that was a long night last night. And get the stakeholders involved in your future plans. These young teenagers that you see right here, they were at one of our open houses, and by the time our project is built and constructed, they're going to be young adults. And like some teenagers, they may very well pay attention to how we handle this project. Transmission takes a lot of time. That question has come up. There's a lot to do. We have a certificate of need process to go through. We need to analyze routes and find routes and submit a route application, and that takes a considerable amount of time on a 200-mile project. We will have open houses and public meetings through the first half of 2009, and we hope to submit route permits or facilities permits in Minnesota and South Dakota late next year. And also there's federal environmental review to go along with all of that. Easement acquisition is going to take a long time. I imagine that on 200 miles of transmission line, we'll probably have probably a couple thousand parcels to acquire. So, and that takes time as well. Our website, we urge people to get in, they can solicit comments on our website. It's always changing, and we're always soliciting input from people that are on our website to ask us to tell us how we can improve our website as well. You can click right there on the very first page on our website. You can click there to send a message, and also right now, this is an old screenshot, but right now you can click on a message that shows when our scoping meetings are coming up, public meetings for that. And always, people contact us. We've had a lot of mailings go out, the website, and we always urge people to contact us, and I think we do a good job of responding to any phone calls, emails, letters that do come our way. So how are we going to know if we've been successful? How do we measure that success? And I think our success is going to be measured in the quality of our interactions that we have with the public, in the communities, and also with regulators. It's also going to be judged by the extent of our environmental compliance and stewardship, both in the routing process and in our construction process. And it's certainly going to be judged by those who come after us. Our transmission lines are going to be up for decades to come, and with our the people that follow us at our utility companies are going to judge us by these projects, as well as the public that's going to have to look at these things for decades to come as well. Thank you.
Just when you thought there couldn't be any more, you've heard about the queue challenges, the seams challenges, the public involvement challenges, so there's a lot going on. We want to take some time to take questions. If anyone already has some and wants to come up to Mike, sure.
Thanks. Mine is to Randall of Excel. You made the comment in your slide 6, which you unfortunately didn't give to us, but I wrote your quote down. Low load, high wind, quote, at times wind generation can far exceed need, unquote. I'm afraid you've underestimated that, understated that, and also you've also stated that you really don't have any way of getting rid of that excess. I can think of a way, and that's to shut off the generators. So my question to you is, are you writing into your contracts right now, and are you prepared as a utility to shut off the wind generation and turn off your contracts when you don't need it, midnight to 6 a.m., particularly night after night after night? And if you don't, the poor operator is going to have to make that decision, and if he doesn't make that decision, we're going to have 50 million more customers without electricity like we did in 2003.
Today, our contracts are take or pay. So if we tell a wind generator to shut off, we pay them to do so. And we have, it's part of the contract with them, so they do that. The slide is, I was looking further down the road, and the point I was trying to make is we need to build east out of the Twin Cities. Curtailment is expensive. You pay whatever the contract rate for the energy is, plus you pay them for the taxes, the PTC, thank you. So it's very expensive to curtail. And, the state doesn't like it, we don't like doing it, but, that's the reality today. Down the road, in the future, hopefully we won't have to, hopefully there'll be ways to avoid that.
Hopefully is a big word, a lot of money. hundreds of millions of dollars. Just a comment. Thanks.
Yes, we can have the next questioner.
To Claire Miller. And first, I want to commend you for the vision you've laid out for us today. If we can accomplish this by 2030, we've really done something, and it's a great vision. Thank you for your work. But we've had this discussion with MISO before, Claire, and Jim Nichols from Minnesota, and we, my brother and I, we have a successful project and working on the next one. MISO's been good to work with. You got a hell of a job. But you need to do some simple things, and I've said this before. People don't belong in the queue that don't have a PPA. They just don't belong there. And if nothing else, you can say you've got 1 year to get a PPA or you're out. You just had 11,000 megawatts put into your queue. I just printed out your queue list. In a few counties in Minnesota, they don't have a PPA. I mean, I don't know who they are, but this is not viable. And I didn't realize until you laid it out today, when people drop out, you've got to redo the studies and all that. PPA, first of all, says you have to have a viable project, which means you have to sell it at a reasonable price. And I commend Xcel for that because they've been very good. They have to protect their customers, and rightly so. And our politicians in Minnesota have mandated some really dumb projects that hopefully we'll get out from under. We've got a good PUC. But with that PPA, a lot of things go through, and I'm talking mostly to wind. You've got to have a wind turbine bought. You've got to know what your costs are. You've got to have access to transmission. All those problems need to be solved before you get a PPA. Right now, anybody can get in. I mean, send you a few bucks and I'm in the queue. Jesus. You got to set some rules here, and the first one is they got to have a PPA. Thank you.
Sure. Let me respond to that a little bit. On December 11th, there's a FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, conference on queue reform. Among the things that we're working to propose include things like, instead of it being a simple cost deposit for a study, it's a dollars per megawatt. So if one 1,100 megawatt project shows up, it's, you know, a big number. And if the same project is in the queue three times in three different places, it's three times as high. So in a dollars per megawatt, that way we don't discriminate against the smaller projects. But at the same time, if it's a larger project, it's a larger problem, and it's a legitimately higher cost option. So that's one of the things we're going to do.
So the big corporations can handle it and the little guys can't.
Right? That's right. And as I talked about the milestone-based or first finished, first out, we're looking for what the appropriate set of milestones are so that when someone enters the queue, they may not need a PPA. But if someone does have a PPA, they ought to be able to advance past those other projects that aren't as mature. And those are the kinds of things that we're going to be trying to propose. You can expect a regulatory filing out of us in the first quarter of 2008 that's going to try to address some of those issues.
Thank you. If I could just have a follow-up on that line, Claire. What is, in your judgment, is there reason for optimism as we look at potentially reforming the queue process, or is this going to be one of those very frustrating things where people talk about the need for it and we see very little action?
The reform is going to help the older projects that are in the queue, but the 11,000 megawatts of requests we got since September 10th are still a long ways from us being able to address their issues. The fact that we've got the 58,000 megawatts of wind against 12,000 megawatts of renewable portfolio standards, there's going to be a lot of friction. We got plenty of suppliers, and we need to find the demand for that. The optimists say, well, there's plenty of demand out there. It's going to be bigger than that. Go ahead. I haven't found anybody who's willing to pay for the transmission based on that optimism.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Kevin Porter from Exeter Associates. Let me just pile on the queue issue a little bit more. One is, I'm wondering if, I've always wondered if the year in and year out of the PTC kind of aggravates the queue problem, whether that causes some of the flood, and I wanted some people to maybe comment on that. And two, I'm wondering, is it time, we've talked a little about cost allocation, is it time to reopen the RECB discussions? Instead, this is one of those acronyms that, I know the acronym, but I don't know the term. But whether it's time to go away from the 50-50 sort of cost split and to do something different. Thank you.
RECB is regional.
Energy production
no, no, RECB is our tariff name that is regional expansion criteria and benefits.
What's it mean? What's it mean?
Well, it was a really good thing to say, so it was easy. And what it's about is as we work through trying to find different ways to share cost for transmission infrastructure, one of the things that was in the middle of that long discussion, it was about a 24-month discussion, in the original tariff, the transmission owners had to repay the developers 100% of the cost of network upgrades, transmission upgrades, to accommodate their plant. In the PJM interconnection, the transmission owners pay zero to the developers for the transmission upgrades. We had an 18-month argument, and we split the baby 50-50. Because the Midwest ISO is so big, folks in Ohio are looking and they're saying, you know, if it's 100% the transmission owner pays, all of the generation in the entire footprint is going to be in North Dakota, and we're going to pay for it in Ohio. And we think coal's great because we got a lot of it. Why would we do that? Okay, so that's the other end of that same question. So the 50-50 is one piece of it. The other piece of it is how broadly do you distribute that cost between all of the participants in the Midwest ISO? We're in, we've got 114,000 megawatts of demand from Manitoba to Kentucky. The renewable portfolio standards are in the West. They're starting to grow in the East. They're not there yet. So what, you know, if you're in Missouri and you don't have a mandate, and we've got a tariff that has Missouri share the cost, and the cost is driven by the mandate, they're not very interested in paying that. And it's that kind of a quagmire that we're in terms of the cost sharing around transmission. You can expect the RECB will be back on the table. It's the most divisive issue we have. We have transmission owners that think we're already sharing too much. We have transmission owners that think we're sharing not nearly enough. We joke that it'll end up being RECB the 13th. And I've got an employee named Jason that I'm going to put on the case because it is a real horror story and a really hard problem.
Looks like Commissioner Weefall gets the final question, and then we'll wrap things up for the day.
Thank you very much. I found the statistics that were presented this afternoon just fascinating. The one in the MISO queue where we just talked about how there's 26,838 megawatts in the queue in Minnesota alone. And yet when the person from Xcel Energy told us that all Minnesota utilities are going to need renewable energy requirements of 6,800 megawatts, you know, that's a big disconnect. So as a person who's responsible for trying to plan for my state, what do you think I should use as the reasonable number that will be built? I'm sure South Dakota's looking at that too because they've got over 11,000 in the queue. What's the reasonable number that will be built that we can think of to plan for as we're looking at these queue numbers versus the numbers of what's even required by the Renewable Energy Acts?
Sure. The second thing about queue reform that we're going to propose is essentially going to take the renewable portfolio standards and name them as a minimum demand. And we're going to look for a transmission build-out that would accommodate that 13,000 megawatts of legislatively mandated wind. Between the queued requests in the regions, we think we can define what appropriate places for that superstructure is, if you will, and then we'll let the queue process define which of the projects can connect to that superstructure. So that's the strategy we're going to try to propose this spring, Commissioner, and we're really hopeful that can break the logjam so that we're at least building that much transmission, because we know at least that much transmission will have customers in states that are willing to pay for the transmission because they're under a legislative mandate to do so. So that's where we're going to try to go.
Thank you. And before the final word, I just want to say, as one of the political types. I think this conference is real helpful for those of us in the political process. They obviously, as you look at what wind energy can deliver in terms of benefits to the environment and other areas, it's a very exciting future, but one with many challenges. And I think from my standpoint, and I suspect from the other political folks in the crowd, that it's conferences like this that serve as a catalyst for a solution. So we certainly thank the organizers for doing this. I certainly thank the members of my panel for providing a lot of illumination, and look forward to the reactions in the final segment of this conference tomorrow from you in the audience as we search for solutions to these many problems.